This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We often interview rock performers on Fresh Air, and we were beginning to notice a trend. Some of the more interesting albums by performers who had been our guests, like Richard Thompson, Los Lobos, Elvis Costello, and Peter Case, were produced by Mitchell Froom. Once we realized that, we figured it was time to invite Froom to talk with us. This seemed like a good time to do it. He produced the latest albums by Suzanne Vega and Los Lobos. Suzanne Vega came out of the folk scene. Her new album, 99.9 Fahrenheit Degrees, has a different, much noisier sound. Let's listen to Blood Makes Noise. I asked producer Mitchell Froom if Suzanne Vega came to him with a specific idea of what she wanted on this album.
I think she was just interested in having her records have a little bit more projection and a little more intensity. And she had made some different kinds of demos before we got together and sent them off to a few people, and I guess she liked what I said the best, so I got the job.
What did you say?
Well, I'd liked her acoustic demos better than the band demos that she had done, and I told her why, and I think basically the idea was that I'd felt that in the past, perhaps the musicians that had worked on her records tended to listen more to the tone of her voice and the prettiness of her guitar playing and not pay as much attention to the lyrics, and so oftentimes the music tended to get a little bit pretty, whereas I thought it would be a lot more interesting if the music reflected the darkness of what she was talking about. So,
did that lead to your overall vision for the record?
Yeah, I did a lot of thinking about it, and then things just developed pretty quickly. We got together and worked in a little rehearsal studio, the two of us, just with her playing guitar and singing, and I just had a few keyboards, and just tried to figure out, I mean, her music is actually, I think, in its most natural state, wants to be kind of a weird hybrid of things, and that's kind of what I think we got onto anyway, I hope.
Mitchell Froom, you've also produced the latest record by Los Lobos. Give us a sense of what your overall vision was for this album.
That record really was, it had a particular quality about it. I mean, we had spoken up front about how, you know, we weren't going to be confined by the tyranny of the band necessarily, and that we were just going to experiment. But it became, as it progressed, it really became kind of, I hate to use the word breakthrough, but it had that quality to it. And it was for them, and it was for me, and it was for the engineer that I work with. And we just came up with all these notions and all these ideas, and we just kept getting wilder and wilder and less afraid as we went along, and it was just a lot of fun. Nothing took very much time, but we got on to some fairly radical things, I think, pretty quickly. And
what's an example of one of the radical things you tried on this?
Well, you know, again, like Suzanne's record, it's kind of a weird hybrid of numbers of different kinds of music, but it you know, just put together hopefully in kind of an unexpected way, like, you know, Kiko and the Lavender Moon. Some people have thought that it kind of has some Ellington-style harmonies to it, you know, with sort of a Cuban beat, and then there's a guitar in there that sounds like it was recorded in Egypt sometime, and, you know, there's just a lot of strange things going on, and it somehow doesn't sound like it's being smug or or trying to be too clever with itself. At least I hope not. That's not the way it strikes me. I really love that track.
On the track Kiko and the Lavender Moon, did you do any of the arranging on that track? What was your contribution to the sound?
Well, what sounds like saxophones is actually a keyboard that I'd played just along with the track, thinking that we were going to replace it later with Steve Berlin, you know, on saxophones. But that particular keyboard, it just had such an atmosphere about it that we just left it. But basically, all the parts in the song, David had come up with up front. You know, even the quality of that saxophone part, the harmonic content of that was stuff that he had come up with. I helped orchestrate it somewhat, but we did that very quickly. It becomes one of these things where between the engineer and the band and myself, that ideas just bounce around and you try things quickly and throw them away. And, you know, we did that whole track, I think, in a day and a half, and what you hear was a 5-minute rough mix of the song.
You kept the rough mix?
Yeah, sometimes, particularly with something like that, there becomes a blend that you can't ever get back.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried for not very long to beat it, and then we just decided we'd live with a little more tape hiss, and maybe the world would forgive us, you know?
Right. You use the expression "the tyranny of the band." What did you mean by that?
Oftentimes, when a group is together a long time, and they've found things that work initially, they tend to bring the same thing to the music as time goes on, figuring, well, it worked once, so it works again, and it's hard to shake that up, and you have to be willing to look at a recording not as a documentation of live performance, but as a recording in itself. And if there was a switch, that was probably, you know, that was probably the switch of that. They really didn't care who did what and how anything happened. And the roles were changed all around. You know, that it's just a difficult thing sometimes. Bands have upsides and downsides. And the downsides can be that after a while bands play the same way. You know, they hear a new song and they'll just play it the same way they played an old one, and it won't be as good because it doesn't have any discovery to it or any tension to it. You know, they're just too comfortable with it. So
why don't we listen to Angels with Dirty Faces? I'm going to play this because I like the way the synthesizers and drums are integrated together.
Uh-huh.
You know,
there's no synthesizers.
There's no synthesizer, okay.
No.
So why am I thinking that there is?
I'm not sure. I think a lot of it has to do with the recording technique.
Mm-hmm.
And there's lots of distortion used. There is a little bit of a loop going on, but that comes from a strange little instrument that's called a stereophonic octagon that was made, I think, by Sears in the 60s, and it's a very small part of it, but it kind of creates the impression that there's a record scratching along with the, you know, your surface noise. But, you know, for example, I think the drums on that track were recorded onto just one track with one microphone with some really rotten distorting compressors. And so, you know, it actually, there's very little going on in that. There's definitely no synthesizers.
Now, the rotten distorting compressors, was that, were they intentionally rotten and distorting?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the engineer I work with, Chad Blake, that's his particular, you know, that's his particular specialty, is that sort of thing. And
what do you like about the sound it gives you?
Well, it sounds like it's breathing. And a big thing about that record for us as a team, because we've worked together now almost 7 years, and with that record, for the first time, I think we really felt like we came on to something that was more unique and could be applied in different ways to different people. So it's not like, you know, some producers are associated with a sound, and it's not like that sort of thing. It's not... you know, trying to mold artists to your sound, but it's a helpful way of just getting some soul and some rawness into a record. You know, people always try to get that thing of the way old records sound, and a huge part of it is the fact that recording techniques weren't as pristine, and there was a lot of distortion going on, and the high end wasn't as clear, and the result was just the music sounded much rawer. And in those days, you know, like, for example, if you listen to some of the Stax catalog, they were trying to make the music sound as pretty as they could. That's just the best they could do, but it still had this great raw sound. Now we have so many options and so many ways of cleaning things up that you tend to forget, you know, what the function of instruments are and the emotion of them can be. So in addition to getting away from the tyranny of the band type situation with Los Lobos, I felt we also got away from the tyranny of the studio.
Right. Let's listen to Angels with 30 Faces.
With one shoe on.
Usually when you produce an album, you're also featured on keyboards. You're credited on the Los Lobos records as Mitchell Froom and his house of keyboards.
Right.
Now, there's someone, you know, who already plays keyboards in the band. How do you decide who's going to do what there?
It doesn't make any difference. In fact, a few played keyboards. David played piano on the record, and Steve Berlin played. And, for example, on that song Just a Man, David suggested that I play the piano part, but he had written it, and I liked the way he played it better than I could. There was more struggle in there, should we say. You know, I would have probably done it a little bit smoother, and it just doesn't matter. And the reason why I have a house of keyboards is they're mostly old keyboards that have weird overtones and react different ways every time you play them, and it's that sort of thing. And the reason why I have them around is so that there can be situations where somebody who doesn't play at all can sit down and find a couple notes they like, and then that'll be it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's the quality of that record was one of very little ego anywhere. You know, they had Steve Berlin is a record producer in his own right, and he was extremely helpful, and he was really great about the whole process. There was no tension between us about what was going on. We just wanted the music to be good, and as long as there's that kind of quality to the thing, and it's not a pompous situation, or people aren't overly smug about what they're doing, and that the focus is always just on what's coming out of the speakers, things tend to work out better.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mitchell Froom. He's a record producer who's produced records for Los Lobos, Suzanne Vega, Elvis Costello, Richard Thompson, Peter Case, and others. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Record producer Mitchell Froom is my guest. What is the job of record producer the way you would define it?
It's belonging to a club that you're not proud of. well, in the best of all worlds, I would hope that being a record producer is being able to identify where it is that you're needed and to be able to provide that service, which means understanding your own limitations and figuring out what it is that you may be able to offer your assistance in what way. And my ideas have been changing over the years about it, but that I think that's basically the job.
Yeah,
my problem is that I'm, like I say, I'm not particularly proud of the company that I keep. I think in general that records would be better without record producers.
Why?
Well, you hear demo tapes that have a lot of personality, and then you hear a generic version of that once the record comes out. And even though there may be more rough edges or the arrangement may not be what you would call standard song form, those are all the things that are great about it. And so many records get lost in the shuffle, and so much personality goes by the wayside.
Is that because, do you think the record company wants it that way, or is it just that the personality of the producer is so big it overwhelms that of the performer?
Well, there's a one thing is that I've noticed is that record company involvement oftentimes, now fortunately this is not on records that I tend to work on, but they tend to fixate on saying that the artist needs really great songs. Their definition of what a great song is usually the opposite of my definition of what a great song is, which is they like the standard form, the well-crafted, predictable type song. And, you know, why should somebody have a chorus at all if they don't want a chorus? You know, if they have a good idea and what they're doing has emotion to it, why should it be constricted into a form? And then the record producer gets a hold of it, and there nowadays, like I mentioned, there's just a lot of ways to go wrong in the studio. There's I think it was much easier making records when there was less tracks, when fidelity was worse, and there was less money to be made, because things were done quickly, and if it was good, it was good, and you could tell right away, and you just get things the best they could be, and then they're done. But nowadays, there's so many things that you can do, and there's so many ways to get distracted. And oftentimes, I see record producers with the idea of, well, this is my production, and so everything is going to be just right. I don't want to be known for any kind of shabby work. And the result of that kind of thinking is often a record with no warts. And it's depressing.
How often do you use synthesizers on rhythm tracks in your productions?
Synthesizers? I've got some synthesizers, but I don't think I don't remember the last time I used them. I have some analog ones. It's another thing that kind of saddens me about the state of music nowadays is I don't think I've heard a keyboard that's new that has any kind of sound to it that I can even relate to. And I don't know how someone who's coming up and is faced with that can even function in the world. There seems to be this trend, and you even see it in pianos, and you see it in guitars, and you see it in the definitely synthesizers, where any possible overtone is gotten rid of, and every sound is finished and polished and has absolutely nothing to offer. No, there's no personality. And even here in grand pianos, they've managed to take the overtones out of things so they can get a very pristine sound. And there's no character to it. So how is anyone, if they're a serious pianist, how are they going to find the notes that may have more character? And, you know, I've heard classical pianists say that they find the four or five notes that are great and they try to emphasize them. That might be a bit much, but there's just nothing to lean on with these things.
You've played in bands on tour. You've toured with Elvis Costello. You've toured with Richard Thompson. How do you
I never toured with Richard Thompson.
Didn't, you just played with him on in the studio?
Yeah.
Okay.
I wish I would have, but... And Elvis, I really only toured with the Confederates, but it was only about 4 weekends, so I wish I could have done more. That was really, really fun. I was honored to be in that company of those musicians. That was really great.
Well, how do you like being on stage as opposed to in the studio?
Well, I've been thinking about doing more, and I've played live with Tom Waits a few times when he's through L.A., and this group Crowded House I work with, I usually play with them, and I've... You know, when Elvis comes through town, if he wants, I'll play. It's just the thing. It's just the idea of being able to throw the notes out there and not having to hear them back is really fun. And I think it would maybe do me some good to do some more of that.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. I'm very flattered that you asked me.
Mitchell Froom is a record producer based in L.A. He produced the latest albums by Suzanne Vega and Los Lobos, as well as albums by Richard Thompson and Elvis Costello. This is Fat Man and Dancing Girl from Suzanne Vega's new album, 99.9 Fahrenheit Degrees. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.